Welcome to the best podcast in the history of mankind. It's Monty's Rockcast. And now, here's your host, Monty Coleman.
Hey, it's Monty. Welcome to the Rockcast. So glad you could join me, and frankly, I'm flattered that you would take the time to listen to me. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this is going to be a pretty good episode. As always, I'll read some of your messages, I'm going to play you some cool tunes, I'm going to review some new CDs, and possibly tell you what I've been watching on TV. But before I get to all that, I decided that I'm going to talk about something that I hadn't really planned on talking about until the other day. You see, a friend of mine sent me a very rare old picture of me when I was playing in The Awful Truth. And so I posted it on Instagram and Facebook. And usually when I post a picture of my paintings or something like that, I'll get 50 to 75 likes and a few comments. But for this picture, I got about 500 likes and over 100 comments. And when that happens, I usually think, oh, okay, I get it. My self-worth basically comes down to whether I have a bass in my hand. Other than that, people really don't care that much.
That's correct.
And so I thought, okay, if that's what people are interested in, I'll talk about it. And so today, I'm going to give you the awful truth about the awful truth.
I'm not interested!
Now, back when I first started the Rockcast, it was around, 2009 or something like that, I did a whole episode on the Awful Truth album. But since it's been so long since I did that, I figured, you know, most people either didn't hear that or you forgot everything that I said. So here is a not so brief history of what went on with that and some of my thoughts. And obviously these are my thoughts and my opinions and my recollections. And there may be at least one person who will disagree with what I have to say, but hey, they can do their own show. But let me start out by saying that The Awful Truth was a trio. It was comprised of David Olerking on guitar and vocals, Alan Doss on drums, and I was the bass and background vocalist, along with Alan. And the three of us met when we were hired to be the backup band for a Christian artist named Morgan Cryer. This was around 1987 or 88, right in there. And Alan and I played with Morgan for about a year, but David only lasted about a month. And there's no good way to say it other than that David was fired by Morgan. Not because of his playing, but because Morgan didn't like him. But eventually Morgan let all of us go, and I was without a job, and I didn't know what I was going to do. But shortly thereafter, I got a call from David, and he said, "Hey, I'm starting a band. Would you want to be in it?" And at first I was a little leery because I didn't really get along with David in the time that I was with him in the Morgan Cryer band. But I eventually thought, you know, David's a really good songwriter, and I've got nothing else going on right now, so what the heck? And so I went over to practice with him, and he had a female drummer named Katrina. And we learned a bunch of David's songs, and we went out and played a couple of gigs. And Sam Taylor came out and saw us, and he said, "I really like you, but I think you should change drummers." And he said, "I think you should get Alan Doss." And Alan was actually playing with another band at that point, but David talked him into it, and he came aboard. And when that happened, things really started to gel. Around this same time, I found this Kramer 8-string in a pawn shop. As I recall, it cost about $400 or $500. I put it on a credit card, got it home, hooked it up to a distortion pedal, and it sounded like a guitar and bass playing at the same time.
Thank you.
David had a massive pedal board and he used a ton of effects, but his guitar tone and my bass sound kind of complemented each other. And when he would take a solo, there was no drop off. That distorted bass just filled everything up. Initially, we were just doing David's songs, but I also wrote, so I started bringing in my stuff. At first, David seemed welcome to the idea and he seemed cool with it. His moody, atmospheric style mixed with my heavy metal influences really started forming a unique sound. The next step was just start playing out live as much as possible. We would basically take any gig anywhere and play for any audience. And we ended up having some weird shows. One night we opened for a recording artist named Jane Seabury, or Seabury. I'd never heard of her, but she was a real mellow, kind of acoustic kind of thing. And the crowd that night, I'm gonna say, was 90% lesbian. And they just looked at us like, what the hell is this? A look that I became quite familiar with over the course of my career. Over 30 years later, when people think about the Awful Truth, if they ever do, they may be under the misconception that we were really big in Houston. But no, we played most of the time for empty bars and we never really got a following of any kind. There were a few people here and there that loved us. In fact, two of the guys were Ben Huggins and Dane Sanye. Those guys would come out to our shows. But for the most part, we were playing for really small crowds, and some nights we'd be playing for the bartenders. But it didn't matter to us because we were focused on the big picture. I just wanted to get signed, make an album, and one day go on a national tour. And that's really all that kept me going. Because the entire year I was in that band, I didn't make a dime. Yeah, we were playing every single week, but it was basically for free. Because any money we did make went back into the band to pay for stuff like van rental. David worked out a deal with the owner of this seedy punk bar in downtown Houston called the Axiom. And even though we rarely drew any kind of a crowd, they let us play there every Wednesday night. And my Wednesdays would always go like this. I'd leave around 10 in the morning, go pick up the van, drive to David's and load up the equipment. We'd then go to the Axiom, set up, sound check, and then wait around till about midnight to play. We'd then play the gig for a handful of people, then load up the equipment, drive back to David's, unload the equipment, and then I'd take the van, drop it off, and then head home. And usually I'd get there about 6 a.m. This was obviously not paying any bills, so I got a job working for a service company doing inventory. Yeah, have you ever been to a Walgreens or a Target and seen these guys walking around in khaki pants with a calculator on their hip? And they're standing there counting bottles of aspirin? Yeah, I was one of those guys. That was not fun, but I just kept believing it would all be worth it someday. Obviously, none of us had any money to pay for studio time. But since Sam Taylor was managing us, he wanted to see us get signed, so he took us into the studio and covered the cost. We did demos for 4 or 5 songs, most of which were some of our heaviest tunes. Stuff like Higher, Ghost of Heaven, and another song that I co-wrote called Drowning Man. I have to admit that I was kind of nervous being in the studio because it was the first time I'd ever been in a recording studio. But it was sounding really good and Sam was triple tracking the background vocals, and when I went into the control room and heard what was coming out of the speakers, well, I couldn't believe my ears. I we got done recording the four or five songs, Sam took the demos and started shopping them. And we pretty much immediately had interest from Arista, Atlantic, and Johnny Z from Megaforce. We were still playing for very small crowds, but now there were occasionally A&R guys from labels showing up. One guy had signed the Indigo Girls, and for some reason he was interested in signing us. Another guy liked the way we played, but he didn't like David's lyrics. He just kept saying, "You guys need to work on your lyrics, work on the lyrics." And he even sent us a few pages of lyrics that he felt were good lyrics. But when we read the words that he sent us, we just kind of looked at him and laughed. We decided to just stay who we were, words and all, and that this A&R guy was probably just trying to justify his job or prove how smart he was. Which, by the way, is the way most A&R guys are. Not all of them, but a lot of them. But the guy that seemed the most interested was Johnny Z from Megaforce. He, of course, the guy that helped Metallica and Anthrax and Overkill get their starts. And so I was so stoked at the possibility of being on that label. Johnny told Sam that he loved how heavy it was, but he wanted to hear more songs. So we quickly went back to Rampart Studios there in Houston to do four or five more songs. However, this time they were all David songs and they were kind of on the mellow side. A little bit more ballady and a little bit more like, let's say, The Cure. And don't get me wrong, I thought they were all good songs, but they were definitely a little bit different than the first batch we'd sent him. But my feeling going in was, hey, we can still make them sound like us. Well, one of the days we were in there, we were working on this ballad, and I noticed that David hadn't been speaking to me. He was kind of giving me the cold, silent treatment. And I thought, well, maybe he's just having a bad day, or maybe he had an argument with his wife or something. And this goes on all day long, and finally that night we have a band meeting. And Sam sits us all down and says, okay, what's the deal? What's going on? And David says, I don't want Monty playing distorted bass on my song. And I said, are you serious? This is what this has all been about? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, screw you. Ah! And Sam was like, all right now, don't make it personal. And I don't remember for sure, but I'm guessing that I probably played the song without distortion. And we left the studio, and Sam sent a new batch of demos to Johnny Z, and he hated them.
Oh!
He said, nope, not heavy enough, not what I'm looking for, no longer interested. And so at this point, the plan was, okay, let's go to Austin and play the South by Southwest Music Festival, or whatever they call it. There'll be all kinds of record labels there, and we can do a showcase. Well, the night before we leave, Sam and David get into some big argument over something that seems trivial to me. And I thought, well, this isn't good, but on the other hand, it's not really out of the ordinary. So we go to Austin, we set up in this place called Club Sandwich, which sounds really lame, but it was actually a nice big club. And that night it was packed out, there was a ton of A&R guys running around checking us out. Well, we went on, and I was playing like a man possessed. And I went at it like my whole future was at stake. Which is kind of the way I play every time I play, but anyway, this was serious. Well, one of the things that we were kind of known for our live shows was that David would fill the entire stage with candles. That's right, lit candles. Well, a few songs into our set, it's just getting unbearably hot on stage. And I'm playing with that aluminum neck bass, and it starts going out of tune. And so I'm dealing with all that, but at the same time, it felt like we were crushing it. And we get to the last note of the last song, and David takes his guitar, walks over towards Sam, and just smashes it right in front of him. Now, was this something that David did intentionally out of spite towards Sam? Well, I can't say for sure, but I know that Sam felt like it was. Well, the next day, Sam called another band meeting, and he calmly started it by saying, okay, I'm not going to work with you guys anymore. I've got a guy who will continue shopping your demos, but I'm done. Well, upon hearing this, I was just devastated. I thought, you know, David has blown this thing up and cost us all a record deal. But then I thought, you know, on the other hand, we put all this work into it, and if Alan's still on board, let's stick with David and give it a shot. And so the next morning, we met with this lawyer guy who was going to shop our demos. And one of the first things he said was, okay, I understand you guys don't get along with Sam. And I said, well, no, it's not all of us. I get along with him fine. It's David. Well, that pissed David off, and he told me I was a coward, I guess for telling the truth. But I thought, okay, whatever, I'll go at this like it's a business. We don't have to be friends, we just have to make it work. Well, we still had a few shows booked to do, and as things went along, I noticed that my songs were no longer in the set list. Strike one. Also at this time, David no longer had a phone. And he was basically running everything at that point, and the only way you could talk to him was if he would call you. Strike two. Another thing was that David didn't have a car or any form of transportation. And the night before one of our last gigs, he calls me. And he says, I found somebody that has a van, but you'll have to let them use your car while we take their van. And I said, well, I don't really want to do that. To which, he just hung up on me.
Oh, boy.
Well, the one thing that he must not have realized is that the one thing you don't want to do to me is hang up on me. We can talk or argue all night long, but if you hang up, that's a sign of ultimate disrespect. And when that happened, I said, strike three, I'm out. And mind you, this was only a couple of weeks after I said, well, I'll give it a shot. But I thought, no, this is not going to work. I can't work with somebody like this. Only problem was we still had one show booked. And I did not want to tell David before the show that I was going to quit because I knew he was going to be mad at me and I didn't want to be on stage with that going on. And so I talked to Alan beforehand and he said, yeah, I'm with you. Do you want to start another band if we do this? And I said, yeah, that'd be awesome. And so we went on that night and played the whole show with David not knowing that was it. And looking back, maybe that was wrong, unfair on our part, but I just really didn't want to deal with the drama. And after we played the last song, we went backstage and I just said, listen, it's over. And not surprisingly to me, David did not try to talk me out of it. He didn't offer any solutions or ask me why. Instead, he said, fine, this will go right on without you. And I'll never forget him saying, and I quote, I am not the Antichrist, which I found really weird. But that's kind of the way it was for me dealing with Mr. Von Oehlerking. There were days when he could be a really nice guy, but for the most part, I found him selfish and immature and ultimately impossible to work with. But a day or two after that final show, David had already found a couple of people to play in his band. And interestingly enough, the person he found to play drums is now my girlfriend, Alex Kaufman. David changed the name of his band to In the Garden, but that version of the band didn't last that much longer either. As for me, I really thought my career might be over. But Alan and I did stay together, we started writing songs, and about 6 months later, we signed to Geffen Records. But I'll be honest, for years, I had a lot of resentment toward David. But over the course of time, I finally said, you know, that was a long time ago. And I sent David a message on Facebook, and I just said, listen, man, I'm sorry for how all that went down. You were probably right about some things, and I know I was probably wrong about some things. And I just want you to know that I'm sorry. And he said, yeah, we're cool. And so I thought that kind of closed the door on things. But since then, he's gone on Facebook and said some really hateful things about me, called me some really vulgar names, called me a sellout, and he's also recently been kind of shitty to Alex. And so apparently nothing's really changed over the years. I'm not sure if he plays music anymore. I know that he still paints, and a lot of his stuff looks really cool. I don't think there was ever any doubt that he was really talented, but so was I, and I don't think a lot of people realized that until I left The Awful Truth. When I was in that band, David did all the artwork, he wrote most of the songs, and when I started Galactic, people were like, "Oh, you do art too?" And I was like, "Yeah, I've got a degree." So leaving The Awful Truth was one of the best things I could have ever done. It worked out well for me, but at the same time, I got a lot of experience while I was in that band, and I kind of just carried that on over into the next stage of my career. Strangely enough, after we'd already broken up, Metal Blade Records came along and said, "Hey, we'd like to put the demos out as an album." I think they offered us $5,000 to $10,000 for the masters. I can't really remember. But I do remember that after we got through paying Sam and the lawyers for all of their time and the studio expenses, there was not much left. And then after all that, I found out that David wanted paid back for all the candles he had bought.
Oh, isn't that great?
When everything was finally all totaled up, Alan and I received a check for $500 apiece.
Wow.
That's right. I played for a year, I recorded an album, and I had $500 to show for it. But I also got that plastic CD, and every now and then I still have people tell me that they like it. And if you're one of those people, I say thank you. And now you know a little bit more of the awful truth about the awful truth. I got some listener messages and emails I wanted to get to. And the first one is from Skip Strong. And he says, "Here's a question. While it may not be the standard, why is it that track 3 is oftentimes the first release or first single from an album?" Well, good question, Skip. I'm not totally sure about the number 3 thing. I think a lot of bands just try and put their best songs up front. But I know for Galactic Cowboys, we never worried that much about singles because we figured we weren't going to get any airplay anyway. I mean, at first, we kind of thought we might have some songs that could be hits, but I think most of our songs were just a little too weird. So we just kind of sequenced our albums so there was a good flow to it and that it would take you on a nice journey. But if you're a huge band that knows it's going to get a lot of airplay, I'm guessing they probably say, "Yeah, let's put that hit single at 2 or 3. After all, most people probably don't have a big attention span, and they won't listen past the first 2 or 3 anyway.
Morons.
But thank you for that question, Skip. Next, Sabrina Nelson on Facebook said, "Hey, Monty, you probably don't care about the Rock Hall, but who would you want in there?" You know, Sabrina, I've kind of lost track of who they put in there and who they haven't. I know they've inducted a lot of people that have nothing to do with rock and roll, and so overall, I'm just kind of disgusted with it. But if they ever wanted to make it a little more legitimate, I would like to see them put in some people that influenced me. For instance, I'd like to see Thin Lizzy, I'd like to see Kansas, I'd like to see UFO. I'd also like to see someone like Peter Frampton or Ted Nugent. Both of those guys are reasons why I bought a guitar in the first place. But you're gonna see Taylor Swift in there before either one of those guys, and that's why the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is kind of a joke.
No one's laughing now.
I also got an email from Greg Skipton. And Greg was wondering if I had heard the new albums from Ace Frehley and Mick Mars. He wants to know my opinion and how many bloody metal skulls they would receive. All right, Greg, well, no problem. Let's start out with the new Mick Mars. And let me say, first of all, that I was never a huge Motley fan. I did like them. I went and saw them once and they put on a good show. But they were never one of my favorite bands or anything. But I did check out this new Mick Mars album, and I gotta say, I was pleasantly surprised. It doesn't sound like he just set out to make a Motley Crue album, and it doesn't sound really like Motley Crue to me much at all. Okay, first of all, that is not Mick Mars singing. Most of the vocals on the album were done by Jacob Button, who was also the singer in Steven Adler's band. And I personally think that was a good choice. Guy's got a great voice. Button, as well as Paul Taylor from Winger, also helped with the writing. And it was produced by Michael Wagner. But Mick Mars did play the guitar, which is good since it is his album.
Good thinking.
Overall, I'd say this is a good album. If you're expecting Motley Crue, you may be disappointed, but I was not. I got some good heavy tunes and some good melodies, and that's good enough for me to give it, say, 3.5 bloody metal skulls.
Oh,
right, now for some fun. Anytime I see that there's a new album from Ace Frehley, I know I'm going to have a lot to talk about. And I know in the past I've been kind of rough on Ace. I know he's a living legend, and for that reason we're supposed to give him a big, huge pass. But if we're honest, a lot of his solo stuff has been weak and at times hilariously bad. And it's not that I want to be critical. I would love it if he'd shock me and put out something that was great. And yes, I did say shock me. But once again, he puts out a CD called 10,000 Volts and serves up some rock cast gold on a silver platter.
When I wake up and I'm next to you, it puts a smile on my face.
Okay, I've actually got some good news. To me, this album isn't quite as bad as the last couple solo albums that Ace put out. The lyrics are still pretty bad, but I think by now we've just accepted that that's kind of his thing.
I could not believe my eyes when you
After listening to this whole album, I came to the conclusion that there's a few songs on here that actually had the possibility of not completely sucking. There's at least a couple of songs on here that had pretty catchy melodies that I was almost tempted to sing along to. The problem is, and I know this may sound hateful, but it's Ace's vocals. I know he's got a recognizable voice that you immediately go, oh yeah, that's Ace Frehley when you hear it, but since he's not a great singer, it kind of takes away from the songs. Well, actually, not kind of, it totally takes away from the songs. And I think if he had a really good singer on some of these songs, they might actually be good. Take, for instance, this one.
Dream. Oh, guys in pursuit, there's
If I was going to give Ace Frehley some advice for his next album, it would be find a really good producer and let him tell you when something sucks. But I'm just guessing that he's probably surrounded by people that just go, yeah, Ace, that is awesome, man. You are the man. But you know what? Ace is a legend. He's rich and he doesn't have to listen to anybody, especially me. But in my humble opinion, I don't think this album is great, and therefore I will only give it 2 Bloody Metal Skulls.
Is there anything especially vicious or harsh about that?
Now, I cannot and will not go through this entire episode without reviewing the new one from Judas Priest. It's called Invincible Shield, and I got the deluxe version with extra songs on it. And my first impression is that this album is extremely mellow. Oh, wait, no, that was another album. This thing totally crushes my skull. Yeah, that song was called Sons of Thunder. I'm guessing Rob Halford probably saw us in the movie Airheads playing the band Sons of Thunder and said, hey, that would make a good song title.
Yeah,
probably not. But I like that tune. And if you get this, put some headphones on and bask in the crunchiness of those guitars. They sound great, and apparently Glenn Tipton did play on this album. But I am a big Richie Faulkner fan. I think that guy rules, but the guitars all the way through are very thick and meaty. Like I said, there is a deluxe version of this album, and I would suggest getting it. I probably still like their last album, Firepower, better than this, but there's some really good chunky metal on here, and sometimes that just hits the spot. And even though Halford is, what, like 90 years old now, he still sounds great. So I'm going to give Invincible Shield 3.5, maybe even 4 Bloody Metal Skulls. But I'm All righty. I know you're probably dying to know what I've been watching on TV. So here you go. First up, Alex and I watched the entire Fargo series on Hulu. I'm not usually into drama type shows, but this was really good. Especially season one with Billy Bob Thornton. That guy was one of the greatest villains ever. He was such a horrible person, I almost wanted to like him. And I think that's called great acting.
How messed up is that?
Now, another series that we watched that I did not like was Love is Blind on Netflix. It's one of those, quote, reality shows where people in their 20s and 30s are desperate to get married and desperate for attention. And they go in these little rooms that are divided where they cannot see each other and proceed to lie and tell the other person anything they want to hear in order to accept their proposal. And I was completely sick of all these people after episode one. But by the finale, I had an overwhelming hatred for every single person on this show. But really, that doesn't even compare to the disdain I have for the people who make this show. I get that the contestants are pathetic losers who are willing to sell their whiny souls to be on TV. But there's got to be a special place in hell for the producers who use and try to destroy these wannabe celebrities. I started out watching it for just kind of a laugh, but by the end, I just couldn't stop cussing at my TV.
You sound like you're laying on the couch talking to a shrink.
Now, another show that I actually did like on Netflix was the documentary about the making of the We Are the World song and video. If you weren't around back in the 80s, all you gotta know is that the cool thing to do was get all kinds of superstar musicians together and record a song so you could save all the African people from starvation. Apparently, they weren't quite as concerned about the people who lived here, but that's okay. It's kind of like these days when our government sends billions of dollars to Ukraine while they couldn't care less what happens to the people in the United States. But I digress. The fact is that Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie decided that they needed to write a song and record it. The problem was, how do you get a bunch of egotistical superstars together on the same night in the same room? And I won't go into how they did it, but they did it. And I will admit that even though I've always hated Lionel Richie's music, I was impressed with the way he organized everything. And I did find the documentary very interesting. So I would definitely suggest you watch this. It's very nostalgic, and you're going to find out things like Prince was such a douchebag that he couldn't even find it in himself to show up. And you're going to ask yourself things like, what the hell was Kim Carnes doing there? And who let Al Jarreau in the studio?
No one really knows.
But the best part for me was toward the end when they needed to give Bob Dylan a part. And he didn't know what to do or what to sing. Because let's face it, he's like Ace Frehley. He's got a recognizable voice, but he's not a very good singer. And so Stevie Wonder gets him over there on the piano and he starts impersonating him. And he says, do it like this, Bob.
We are the world. We are the children. So make it a better place for you and me.
I literally want to take this pen and jam it in my ear right now.
But anyway, I think you'll enjoy it. Check it out if you've got Netflix.
Gotta see it. I mean, I gotta see it.
Now, before I do the last segment, I wanted to throw this out there. If you get a chance, please check out my website, MontyColvinArt.com. I've got paintings, prints, refrigerator magnets, and I've even got my crunchy CDs on there. And honestly, it's the coolest website in the history of websites. If you're into metal or rock and roll or rock stars or celebrity art, it is a virtual fantasy land of cool stuff. And I wanted to give a special shout out to Robert Sobiech, who a couple weeks ago bought not one, not two, not three, but four of my Cheap Trick paintings. And he now has the whole band on the walls of his house. And if you'd like to commission me to do a painting, I would love to talk to you about that. Just drop me a message. And the question I get a lot is, what would it cost me to have you do a painting? And here's the answer. It depends. First of all, what do you want me to paint? And then second of all, how big? It's kind of like if you went into a tattoo parlor and said, how much for a tattoo? They'd probably say, well, do you want a highly detailed tat that covers your entire back? Or do you want a little bitty skull on your shoulder that's going to take me about an hour?
You couldn't have made a worse comparison.
So those are some things to think about. I'd be glad to talk to you or take a look at what you're wanting.
What are you doing? Go paint!
Okay, the final segment today is Uncle Monty's Listening Corner. And I got the idea for this the other day when I was watching the show Ink Masters. Speaking of tattoos, I don't have any, but I really enjoy watching that show because I like the art of it. And the host of that show is a guy named Joel Madden. And Joel and his twin brother Benji have a band called Good Charlotte. And I know when you probably hear that name, you go, oh, Good Charlotte. Isn't that punk pop stuff? I hate that. And yes, you would be right. But the thing is, with Good Charlotte, I not only like them, I love them. I got their debut album about 24 years ago. And they were young and they were singing about high school stuff. But the songs and the vocal harmonies were just so good. And so I went back and listened to it again the other day. And you know what? I'm still digging it.
But anyway, you go out.
You know, I know there's a lot of reasons why I should probably hate these guys. The Madden brothers own their own companies now, they're rich, and they're married to celebrity women. But over the years, they've matured as songwriters, and probably as people. And the other day, when I heard this song that was on one of their last albums, I thought, man, I wish I would have written this. This is such a great song, I'm actually jealous. The writing, the arrangement, yeah, just check it out. It's called War.
It always hits you the hardest when you are not ready. You better get ready, 'cause here it comes. You know the pain, the fear, the hurt, or did you forget?
Oh,
You know, sometimes you just have to have an open mind and realize that there's all kinds of good music out there if you just give it a chance. But that's gonna do it for me for now. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back soon with more fun and mayhem. But until then, this has been Monty saying take care. Don't let anyone tell you what to like, unless it's me. And
rock on!
So
Monty's Rockcast.